Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. We have a very empowering hour for you today. We start, of course, with the latest on health and healing. University of Freiburg, which is in Germany, they say that lutein, that's L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, shows a lot of promise as treatment for skin aging and inflammation. Well, almost everyone over the age of 30 has some problem with their skin. That's good news. According to this report, the researchers stated that, quote, lutein belongs to a group of flavonoids and can be found in flowers and herbs and vegetables and spices. It plays an important role in defending plants, for example, against ultraviolet radiation by partially absorbing ultraviolet radiation. And what they have found is that this nutrient, this lutein, which you can buy as a supplement, it's very inexpensive, decreases adverse photobiological effects in the skin by acting as a first line of defense. Furthermore, it has strong antioxidant and anti-inflammatory activities, and that's important too, especially on fibroblasts and other elements within the skin. In effect, it helps the immune cells, like macrophages and mast cells and neutrophils and dendritic cells and T cells. And it suppresses a whole series of pro-inflammatory agents. That's very important. So, good news to help de-age your skin and to protect it. This was published in a peer-reviewed journal. We have a lot more in a few moments, how your gut health is connected to how severe COVID-19 will impact you. New review of the studies from Cree University. Now, mind you, I've been saying all along, build up your natural immune system. Anything you can do in the way of lifestyle is under your control. For example, by exercising about a minimum of 130 minutes a week, more ideally around 300 minutes a week, both aerobic and resistance, by having a lot of fresh-made juices and a full spectrum of the juices, from your grape juice, tomato juice, very good. Tomatoes are, by the way, for your immune system and against cancer, but also your dark green vegetable juices, and then supplementing with a diet that is without the meat and the fried chickens and the things you see advertised on television and alcohol as well. Instead, going towards a healthier Mediterranean-style diet. So that's the first line. De-stressing is also crucial. Getting outdoors, getting into the sun, taking vitamin D. And at this time, if I were working in a hospital in any capacity, especially if I were in an ICU, I would be taking at least 15,000 units of vitamin D a day, 10 to 15,000 vitamin C, 50 milligrams of elemental zinc, and those would be the minimum to help my immune system. But I'd be doing other things as well. I would be taking ivermectin. And by the way, there's a lot of new studies on ivermectin. Interesting, the South African government has an advisory body that oversees their medications. And the head of that has been shown with Anthony Fauci, and big supporter of Anthony Fauci's philosophy and practices on COVID. And they said we should not use ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. That's odd. They said it's not approved in the country. That's even odder, because it is. Evidently, they didn't take the time to look at, I believe it's page 67, in their own guidelines. It is a class 3 drug. And more important, there's not a single study that shows adverse effects of ivermectin. In fact, it's been used all over the world for a long time. It's as safe, if not safer, than aspirin. So anyhow, taking ivermectin at a very low dose can help prevent the virus from manifesting. And for those working where they're at high risk, taking a little higher dose, and again, it's a small dose, 8 15 milligrams, is able to stop it. In fact, a lot of the people were able to stop the virus within 2 to 3 days by just taking it with no adverse effects and preventing people from going on to hospital. You do realize then, that do the math, that this would have saved at least, had it been used from the beginning, which it was available and known to protect us, it would have saved at least 300,000 lives. That's a lot of people to save over something that's inexpensive and safe and has been around a long time. The same is absolutely true for hydroxychloroquine, both used with zinc, because zinc is what actually does the killing, and zithromycin. But that's not the politics, and that's not where the money is. So I'm going to play a little clip a little later from a journalist in South Africa who did his homework and now is asking the question, why? Oh, and he found why, but he didn't emphasize it enough. Who supports that agency 90% of their budget? The Bill Melinda Gates Foundation. And what are they not for? Off-patent drugs that are inexpensive that can and have been shown to stop. What do they want? Vaccines. Now, for everyone. And it only is going to get worse. Mark my words, within the next 6 weeks, you will hear where, yes, you've had your shots, your two shots, and yes, there's adverse effects, but let's not focus upon them. The greater good, it's saving lives. How do you know? You won't know for a year. But now the bad news is we got to keep taking these vaccines forever. The word came out today that COVID is going to be here forever. Well, that does make sense. In their mind, it does. So on Monday's show, I'm devoting the entire hour to this topic because it's time we went behind the scenes and saw the truth of what's happening with probably the most scholarly professor on this topic who has information you have not heard before. He believes that he has found not just the smoking gun, but absolute proof of who's behind it and why. And so you're going to hear from him. He's going to lay out the documentation. We've seen the documentation. We've reviewed the documentation to make sure it's accurate. He's only using government figures and charts and statistics. So brand new information. So important that I'll be doing an introduction, and I'm just going to tell you my introduction is going to focus upon someone who I have a lot of respect for, and that is Daniel Ellsberg. Why? Because it was Ellsberg, and by the way, not alone, who first told us about the secret war in Vietnam. Secret because no reports ever made public. From 1945 until it was known that we had advisors in 1967, that this secret campaign bombing North Vietnam, Marine Corps attacks, bombing and fighting in Cambodia and Laos were going on under every administration. It was a 3,000-page historical analysis, 4,000 pages of original government documents in 47 volumes, and it was classified top secret. And the people holding all this was the Rand Corporation. They received, I believe it was 2 copies. Why, Ellsberg knew the leaders of the task force. He had worked as an aide to John McNaughton, and McNaughton was McNamara's Assistant Secretary of Defense. And so Ellsberg had worked on a study and saw the evidence in 1967, and he began to oppose the war when he saw the truth. So he and his friend Anthony Russo photographed the study in October 1969, and they shared it in 1971 with a reporter for the a reporter for the New York Times, Neil Sheehan. Yeah, And they gave 43 of the volumes to him, and then the New York Times began publishing excerpts June 13th, 1971. The first article came out, and boy, it uncovered everything. That stopped the war in Vietnam for all intents and purposes. It lasted many years after that, but at least it stopped it. And it caused a lot of soul-searching about allowing governmental agencies who knew the truth to hide the truth, and millions of people died because of it or adversely affected. Now imagine similarly that there are people who know the truth, have withheld the truth, and are playing everyone. What if we had a modern-day vaccine Vietnam? My guest is the person like Daniel who will expose the truth. So that's coming at you, so let people know you really should tune in on Monday. If Daniel Ellsberg could do it, others could do it today. And we believe we're going to have a historic show. In any case, Chris Hedges is going to be on today, and that's always interesting. He'll be on a little bit, and we'll be talking about things that matter. In fact, the larger consequences of the assault on the Capitol and a new era of social and economic restructuring. And Chris Hedges, as this audience knows, is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activist and investigative journalist. He's also, by the way, a Presbyterian minister and a visiting university lecturer. And for two decades, he was the foreign correspondent in the war zones and conflicts areas of Central America and the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the New York Times. And he's the author of some very important books, including America, the Farewell Tour, which is a deep on-the-ground account of America's accelerating economic and social and political decay. And also, he hosts the weekly TV program On Contact that you can see on Saturday on RussianTVRTV.com. We'll go to him in a little bit. But now back to the latest also on this, talking about your health of your gut. So anyhow, the one area that most people don't realize is that everything they eat or drink will either support good bacteria or support unhealthy bacteria in your gastrointestinal system. And so this gut health now has been shown to connect to your overall immune system. And also, severe cases of COVID-19 often include GI symptoms. And chronic diseases associated with severe COVID-19 are also associated with altered gut microbiota, meaning bad bacteria. And there's a growing body of evidence showing how if you have the wrong bacteria from a wrong diet, it's going to affect your prognosis. And if studies do empirically demonstrate a connection between the gut microbiota and COVID-19 severity, then interventions like probiotics are very important. So why not just realize that reality always supersedes scientific validation? So get on the right side of this issue now. Start eating very good probiotic food. There's a whole variety of yogurts made out of coconut and coconut milk that have probiotics added to them. That's a good way for many people. Also, all types of low-sodium sauerkrauts and kimchi. Tempeh is very good and loaded with probiotics. Beet juice is good as well. So these are the things you can do now to get good bacteria, or just take some probiotics each day in your supplement. Also, if you are really, let's say you're really into health and exercise regularly, you're going to have healthier skin, healthier musculature as you age. But let's say you're a person that spends too much time in front of a computer, television, or in a chair. According to the University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden, that low fitness is linked to higher psoriasis risk. And there's a lot of people suffering from psoriasis. So, yes, there are natural approaches, but one of them is to start to exercise. a lot. So one more reason that you don't want that reddened, flaky, and itchy skin lesions, the plaques of psoriasis. And those, but yet you'll see drugs advertised all the time on television for psoriasis. But understand something. This is now becoming the possibility of adding in to the comorbidities along with obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and depression. And these are all common because they have inflammatory joint conditions, like arthritis is one example. So you don't want your skin being inflamed because that could very probably associate with a worse outcome if you're infected with COVID. So clean up your skin, and exercise is one of the best ways of doing that. Also, from Boston University Medical Center comes a good study about how older, fitter adults experience greater brain activity while learning. That's great. So older adults who experience good cardiac fitness can also keep their brains in good shape as well. So when you go out for that power walk or that bike or jog or the swimming, you're going to end up having a healthier brain. And this was published in the journal Cortex. So your brain benefits from exercise, not just your musculature. And that's good. And for those of you who just can't stop going to the office every day and bring your work home with you, the National Research University shows that workaholism leads to mental and physical health problems or work addiction. And generally that work is not fulfilling. It's not the kind of work you look forward to doing. There's all these hidden stimulators that make us feel somehow we're more worthy if we put in longer hours, get to work early, leave late, take it home with us. Think of the things you sacrifice in the process. Quality time with loved ones. I had a friend, very nice person. This person has passed, had a stroke, was very fit. I mean, outstanding physical condition. And but told me once when I suggested what you're eating is not going to be, let's say, neutralized because of your fitness. If you're going to eat this kind of junk food and clog your arteries, you're putting yourself at risk of a stroke. No, that's ridiculous. You know, I could run all day. I did a marathon. I did, you know, two marathons. London Marathon, San Francisco Marathon, won a gold medal in the San Francisco Marathon. I says, you're conflating an issue. The fact that your body could be fit doesn't mean that it's healthy. You can't see homocysteine, C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, triglycerides. You can't feel them. You can't see them. When they're elevated, you wouldn't know it, and that's what can increase your risk of a stroke or heart attack. And also, you don't know that your arteries don't have plaque in them, lesions in them. You don't know that. But if the diet you're eating, it's known to cause that. And that can shrink the size of the diameter of your arteries and force your blood pressure up. Well, person was adamant that they were healthy and that was it until they had their stroke, their first stroke. And but this person had another issue. In the second stroke, while they were eating a ham sandwich, that's what did it. Person looked up and said, oh no, boom, gone. And a good person, because of that hubris about health. But there was another thing. I remember getting the call one day and said, I need some grieving counseling now. So I went over to the person's place and they were really torn up. Why? Because an hour earlier, they had to take their dog in and put it down. Dog was 7 years old. Why? Well, because the dog had what the vet considered, you know, so many different adverse conditions. It was in pain, and this person had to pick the dog up, a big dog, take it outside, bring it back. Never had time for it. Was always busy. Very successful, very busy. And I said, if you had to do it all over again, Would you be less successful, make less money, and have more time for the dog? And then the person stopped and looked at me. He said, what kind of question is that? I said, well, because had you taken the dog out on a regular basis and really ran with it in the park, it wouldn't have been overweight. Had you taken the time to go and get the food at the store, fresh raw food? Remember, in nature, you don't have, you know, microwave ovens. Monkeys don't suddenly go out and eat something that's been fried or cooked. Animals eat raw food. It's rich in enzymes, and their body's adapted to being able to digest things like that. I said, if you just throw down some kibble in a bowl and some canned food, that's not what they want. That causes them to live half, even a third of their normal lifespan. So the person realized, and actually became aware, that they were actually not engaged in sorrow for the loss of the dog, but rather self-pity for the mistakes they had made, not giving quality time. That's an important lesson in all of our mourning something that has passed, not just passing of a life, but passing of opportunity, passing on the ability to have quality relationships where we're impatient or not open or honest or manipulative in any way. Then now the relationship's gone, and at some point you're going to mourn that, and you're going to ask yourself, what if I'd have been honest? What if I'd been more open? What if I had been more patient? What if, could have, should have? That doesn't help you unless you're willing to start over again and therefore do it right this time. Do I believe in giving another chance? Yes. If what caused the relationship to end was not something where a person went, stole from you or betrayed you. Those, no, I don't give another chance. But for the mistakes in communication, which all of us have engaged in at different times of our life, because no one has that all-knowing awareness of what someone else is feeling, or even in their communication, what they're really saying. Is there a conversation behind the words they're saying that we have not yet interpreted, and should we go deeper? So in that case, we all are at some point affected by what we have passed, what is no longer in our mind's eye, no longer present. You know, the bus has left and we weren't on it. You know, take advantage of something maybe we should have if we were more mature, if we were more prepared, if we were more open, if we were less fearful, if we were less insecure. And but it also applies to animals. I don't believe you should have a pet unless you're going to give that pet lots of time, energy, love, play, and joy in an enhanced environment that allows that pet to know that every time they see you, you're looking forward to being with them. And having an animal sanctuary and spending time every day, 7 days a week, to make sure that those animals have the time that is important to them, it's their time. No cell phones, no distractions. That is a harmonizing relationship. How many people run out in the morning with their dog, run it back up, then go to work and come back 12 hours later, and that poor dog might have been walked by a dog walker, but that's not what the dog wants. The dog wants quality time. People just want to fit all these things in, especially the workaholic. Oh, I've got a child. Yeah, and your child's on drugs, or your child hates you and would like to stab you in the eye because, you know, you're never there, you know, and you just set rules for them, and now they're on Ritalin. And why don't you just give some of that work up? And that's what this study is showing, this National Research University. We just have a really hard time saying no to work and how much of our work really enhances our well-being, that we find joy and growth and happiness. And then can you put that work into your life in a way that does not imbalance intellectual time, creative time, friend time, family time, pet time, your time, exercise time, slow eating time, going for walks in nature time, meditation time, hobby time. You got to put it all in. And what you leave out imbalances you. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We try to get as much in on different topics that are important as possible to get people to think, if nothing else. There's other things happening around the world. For example, Turkey is in a severe drought. Do you remember 10 years ago I said, no society collapses all at once? The world is not going to come to an end all at once. But what happens is it begins to become unstable, then unsustainable over a period of time. Now, some people may raise the alarm, but if the government and the citizenry do not say, yes, this is important, let's deal with this, then you forget about it. Oh, I heard 10 million acres destroyed, those farmers' crops out in Missouri, Arkansas this year or last year. Well, I'm glad I don't live there, but hey, I live here in Brooklyn, everything's fine. So you think, all around us, all over the world, there are now places where you simply can no longer say this is sustainable. Now, not everything is cataclysmic, not everything will collapse, but it's in the process of no longer being livable. Turkey, South Africa, Sydney, and other, in fact, whole countries, Australia, is simply non-sustainable. Turkey's drought, quote, Istanbul could run out of water in 45 days. 45 days for Istanbul. Beautiful city, by the way. Absolutely gorgeous. All of its history. Now, according to The Guardian, the major cities across Turkey are face running out of water in the next few months, with warnings Istanbul has less than 45 days of water left. Poor rainfall has led the country's most severe drought in a decade and put the megacity of 17 million people close to running out of water. That's according to Turkey's Chamber of Chemical Engineers and the Ankara mayor. So why is it that we're now hearing that they only have 45 days? What has been done prior to this? Well, how about not a lot? But we're also seeing similar situations in Bulgaria and in Greece. They've had warming that has destroyed crops. And unfortunately, when you destroy the crops, a lot of people rely upon those both for use in selling locally or exporting. Now you're really water-stressed, and that's not going to allow you to sustain. So if the people don't change, they'll be forced into pulling back or, in some cases, moving out. The fifth largest city in India, large city, it's already out of water. They have to ship in hundreds of trains a day just so the people can have water. And, of course, they have an utterly corrupt government under Modi and indifferent. And he thought he could get away with anything. And then last week, by the way, 250 million farmers went on strike and blocked city streets. Then they stopped the legislation that would adversely affected them. So what happened the week before, the year before, the decade before those farmers finally were in such pain that they had to act? Remember what I've said all along. You will never see Americans do anything constructively challenging authority until they're in so much pain they have no other choice. You know, you hear about someone saying, I had so much pain, I felt like committing suicide. And it's kind of hard almost impossible if you're not in that mindset to realize what does it mean when you're in that kind of pain that you would think that taking your own life is a possible option. But that's what's happening. And then from Northern Arizona University, quote, the earth to reach temperature tipping point. Now, mind you, when we reach this tipping point, nothing we can do will stop it. And then it accelerates at an almost unimaginable speed. And how long do we have? 100 years, 50 years, less than 20 years. That's according to Northern Arizona University, the studies. Quote, the Earth's ability to absorb nearly a third of human-caused carbon emissions through plants could be halved within the next 2 decades at the current rate of warming. This is a new study published in Science Advocacy. So we know that the bad times are coming now and over the next 6 years, but the whole world is at risk. And that's going to be within most people listening right now's lifespan. What are you doing individually? Have you given up meat and dairy? All things that require industrial agriculture and lots of water use. Have you stopped buying things you don't need so that we can save rainforest? What are you doing to conserve water? What are you doing to support local farmers markets and buy locally organically grown produce? Only a small percentage are doing anything about it. So keep that in mind. And that's just to make yourself more aware of it. I'm Gary Nall. We're 30 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have our guest on, Chris Hedges, to discuss what we can learn from the events occurring right now. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. And one of the things that we should be aware of is that we, meaning we, the average person, we do have choices. We can make a difference if we choose to, but we're not going to make any difference that is constructive if we allow others who have an agenda other than our own to make those choices for us. And I'm concerned that we're not looking deeply enough into the consequences of the different players on the national or worldwide stage. From my perspective, it doesn't matter whether you have a Democrat or Republican in the White House. The cabinets that surround these people that are the technocratic or business elite, they don't represent us. Just go back for the last 50 years from Ronald Reagan forward and say, how did we get to where we're at? How did we get all of our jobs offshore to other countries starting in the 1950s? Do we remember when Detroit was one of America's most thriving cities where there was a high standard of living, where nobody had debt? And people could afford a house and paid for it, and we didn't have ghettos? Yeah, those of us who are old enough do remember. What happened to those jobs, and why hasn't anybody ever been held accountable for their loss? Every single administration since then has been responsible for outsourcing jobs. So why isn't that being discussed by the national news media? Why isn't that a story? But it isn't. Why doesn't the national news media ever ask? Here we're praising people like BlackRock, the major corporation, and the people who run it as being so profitable, and people want to invest in it. But how do they make their money? Is there any adverse events occurring because of how they invest their money? The same has to be asked of the energy cartels. Should you be investing in any industry or your pension funds if that money comes on the blood, sweat, and the loss of quality of life for other people? And we're not asking these questions. So I don't trust the major media, even much of the alternative media, to be the oracles to guide us out of the morass that we're in. But Chris Hedges, who I gave you his bio earlier in the program, is here to give us his perspective. Nice to have you again with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris, I believe that it's important you're here today because something that you were writing and talking about years ago is now coming to fruition. You were extremely prophetic. You've been warning about the surge of self-righteous nationalism and its deep hatred towards an open society for well over a decade. And I might mention your book that I read about American fascists back in 2008. Which identified the future dangers of a growing Christian, evangelical, and political right and its predisposition towards violence. All of the gears in the machinery that has become the Trump movement has been in play in other administrations, and especially those that are supposed to be for the people. But despite all of its contradictions and hypocrisy, the Democrats and the media have exhibited an extraordinary incompetence to formulate a viable, alternative, and ethically based narrative to counter it. Therefore, this homegrown American fascist nationalism has largely been allowed to simmer and increase unhindered. And as we know, Biden's win was primarily, from my opinion, and it's subjective, was a vote to remove Trump, and not because the Democrat Centrist Party has anything progressive to offer that would benefit the average working class person. So would you please take your time and give us an insight of what forces you observe behind the visible assault projected as images on our televisions and computer screens that coalesced 9 days ago into the storming of the Capitol? The forum is yours.
Well, this assault is the culmination of several decades of disempowerment and impoverishment and marginalization of, in particular, the white working class. Now, of course, statistically, we know that people of color, and in particular, African Americans, have suffered far worse from austerity programs and deindustrialization. But largely confined to urban centers, the two mechanisms, primary mechanisms of social control, a militarized police force that has the capacity to revoke habeas corpus, due process, even jury trial. 94% of the people in our prison system never got a jury trial. They were coerced into pleading out. And then, of course, mass incarceration itself. You go back to the early 70s, we only had 300,000. Well, only. We had 300,000 people in our prison system. We now have 2.3 million. Some 40% of those people never committed a violent crime. But the assault that deindustrialization visited upon poor people of color has, of course, also been visited on the white working class. And that has been accompanied by a very dramatic shift in the media. So the media itself has now bifurcated into competing silos. They address antagonistic competing demographics. New York Times, the Pew Center for Research last summer did a poll and found that 91% of the readers of the New York Times identify as supporters of the Democratic Party. That's 94% for MSNBC, 87% for National Public Radio. And then, of course, the inverse, where 94-95% of those who watch Fox News support the Republican Party. But what that means is that neither side of the ruling elite is willing to be self-reflective, self-critical, to accept their complicity, responsibility for what's taken place, the most grotesque levels of social inequality in American history. And now you're watching, with the incoming Biden administration, the demonization of the Trump supporters. Remember, Trump increased his votes by over 11 million votes, second highest vote count in American history after Biden. And that's very dangerous because they're not exploring the rupturing of social bonds, what the sociologist Emile Durkheim would call anomy, that has contributed to this, I would argue, legitimate rage and suffering that has been visited on the working class. And what we saw on January 6th was a manifestation of that deep rage. So what's been the response of Silicon Valley and the Democratic Party hierarchy? It's to essentially block out their voice, removing President Trump. And I'm no, of course, supporter of what President Trump sends out on social media, but removing Trump from social media. And this is essentially, a more dramatic form of censorship, but one that has long continued, going all the way back to WikiLeaks. Remember, WikiLeaks, the media platforms managed to block all of the sites where you could donate to WikiLeaks. They created algorithms to steer you away from WikiLeaks content. WikiLeaks would try and hold a press conference. No one could get into the chat room where it was being held, and then they would use electronic interference so you couldn't hear it. And then we saw, on behalf of the Biden campaign, the Twitter block the New York Post from its own Twitter account because it published the revelations on Hunter Biden's discarded laptop, which nobody, by the way, has suggested were false or were fake. You saw the New York Times routinely denounced the John Podesta emails, which WikiLeaks published, as misinformation. That's their word. That's just completely incorrect. Nobody has ever challenged the veracity of the Podesta emails. And then, of course, in the final weeks of the Biden campaign, Silicon Valley spent probably hundreds of millions of dollars on anti-Trump ads. And now, of course, they've moved to shut down Parler. These are digital platforms that control information for billions of people, and they're completely integrated with the national security state. Amazon has a CIA contract worth $600 billion. And there is, we know from the Biden appointments, a deep animus on the part of those within the Biden administration towards the left. So the censorship is actually going to become more pronounced against the left, against those who are left-wing critics of the corporate democratic establishment, because they call them out for who they are. And so I expect that the censorship that we've seen, coupled with the demonization, which I find very frightening. I mean, if you watch CNN, they are calling the people who entered the Congress thugs and criminals and terrorists, and which isn't in any way to condone what they did. But we have to understand what it is that propels this rage, because if we don't re-knit those social bonds, if we don't reintegrate these people into this society, then the violence will become more widespread. I don't think they're going to get anywhere near the Capitol, but there are plenty of soft targets. There was this attempt by people to kidnap the governors of Michigan and Virginia a couple years ago. Somebody mailed pipe bombs, and of course there were pipe bombs found in Washington outside the RNC, to mail pipe bombs to the leaders of the Democratic Party and, of course, CNN. But I expect that I expect the violence to become more commonplace, the political violence, because the response on the part of the Biden administration, the Democratic Party elite in Silicon Valley, is not to address the issues that have pushed people into this kind of extremism, but essentially to ridicule them and to shut down their voice.
Overview. The other night, Chris Cuomo was on one of the panelists at CNN, and it was one of the most unfortunate tirades I had ever heard. In effect, what he was saying is that every person that voted for Trump was a, and then he went into this long list of things that he felt about them, as if they're all of the same mindset, they're all potential terrorists. And now the word is that anyone who voted for Trump should be identified. Anyone who worked in the Trump administration, which are thousands and thousands of people, as there are in every administration, should be deplatformed and not given a job. Nobody should hire these people. And I'm thinking to myself, why is it that you're saying that anyone who voted for Trump is the enemy of America and must be dealt with, and therefore laws and rules, a new form of hate speech is being introduced that it has a broad base capacity to take anything that a person says and make it something into a felony? And I'm thinking, do you really think that you're going to be successful in attacking 74 million Americans, the vast majority of whom are not going to do anything violent? They're protesting. And shouldn't we all have a right to protest? I was abhorred by all of the violence I saw throughout the summer in Portland and Seattle and Ferguson and Chicago and New York. Not the demonstrations. As you know, you and I led a demonstration down in Union Square years ago. I've been a part of hundreds of demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, not violence. And you have to set, you can't conflate the two. And yet now they're conflating as if the people who attacked the Capitol, they represent everyone who supported Trump, instead of looking at the underlying reason many of these, including unionists, including former Democrats, voted for Trump, What in the world did the former administrations do to improve the quality of these people's lives? And that's the question they're not asking. So what do you think about the idea of making everyone who supported Trump now an enemy of the state?
Yeah, well, that's a recipe for complete social disintegration, and you're pushing people into a corner where the only avenue left that they can take in order to express themselves is violence. You're just dumping gasoline on the fire. And, you know, I find the way that people express this rage, which I think is legitimate, repugnant through racist tropes and nativist ideologies and conspiracy theories and everything else. On the other hand, this is what happens to a diseased society. I watched the same thing with the breakdown of the former Yugoslavia. You can go back to what happened in Weimar Germany. So what Biden essentially is replicating historically is the 1932 German government led by Franz von Papen, who wanted to recreate the Ancien Regime, this kind of conservative utopianism. Biden wants to bring back the Clinton-Obama era. When that's not conjecture, because of all the people he's appointed, we fully know what he's going to do and who his interests he's going to serve, while at the same time not responding to the root causes of what it is that has pushed people to carry out this kind of activity and to express, often in inappropriate ways, but to express this deep sense of alienation and anger and frustration. And that is, you know, that's very dangerous, especially given the economic fallout from the pandemic. Before the pandemic, things were bad enough. It's what Barbara Ehrenreich said about the working poor, that, you know, being part of the working poor, and I know you've done a lot of work on this, in the United States is one long emergency. Well, now it's much, much worse in terms of evictions and money running out and small businesses closing right and left. You know, the unemployment figures are fictitious because people who have been furloughed but are never going to be rehired are not counted as unemployed. People who work an hour a week, I'm not making that up, are counted as employed. People whose wages put them below the poverty level are counted as employed. And all those who've stopped looking for work, I think it's for 6 weeks, are not counted as unemployed. Real unemployment is pushing close to 20%. And it's just not the inability on the part of the corporate state to respond to the pandemic. It's not just Trump's ineptitude. It's the fact that we don't have a national healthcare system. Our healthcare system is designed to make money for for-profit institutions. It's why you've seen a complete consolidation, closures of hospitals and clinics in rural and poor areas. We have less than 1 million hospital beds. There's, you know, the whole vaccine rollout has been a debacle. There's no coordination. There's no national infrastructure because our healthcare system is not designed to cope with a national health crisis. So all of the attendant problems that are baked into the system are not going to go away with Biden. There's going to be no attempt to hold police forces accountable for the kind of lawless killings that they carry out against unarmed civilians, because as social unrest becomes more pronounced, the police are the only form of social control that the state has, along with mass incarceration, to keep people in check. I find the kind of willful blindness on the part of the ruling elite, the inability to be self-critical, self-reflective, to understand what it is they have done. I mean, the suffering that these people have undergone is real. The tragedies that have befallen their families, the evictions and all of the pathologies that come with being discarded by a society, opioid use and alcoholism and gambling, the belittling of them as people, which is almost minute by minute occurrence on media platforms like CNN, and then the clear message from the state that they're not going to respond. to that suffering in any meaningful way is, it's very, very ominous.
You did a magnificent book that people should read. It's just as timely today as when you wrote it, about what's going on in middle America to the average person who never seems to end up being interviewed on any of these shows to say what it's like to have worked for all of those decades now to have no job at all, and then what do you do for your family to pay your mortgage and bills. Well, this past year in March, I went back to a small city, 44,000 people in the whole county, and growing up, in fact, 10 years ago when I visited, it was still this wonderful small town environment where everyone knew everyone in your neighborhood and a low crime and a lot of community efforts. And I got early for my reunion. I got there early. I had about 6 hours. So I just walked up and down every street. I mean, that's almost the whole town. All I saw was a ghetto. I would not have believed it humanly possible that the city had just fallen into such a disrepair. On almost every block, I couldn't find a single house that was at least kept up. Fences broken, sidewalks, holes in them, shingles hanging off. I mean, it was just a mess, and I found drug addicts everywhere. So I stopped and talked with them. You know, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Ohio. Why are you here? Well, because, it's the heroin here is cheap, and cheaper than when I can get it over in Ohio. So that night, and this was everywhere, and crime has skyrocketed. So that night, I simply asked my graduating class members, how did this happen? And they said the jobs went. When the factories closed down and went overseas, people who had worked their whole lifetimes for the last 2.5 to 3 generations, now they found themselves without work. And because of that, you only can be on unemployment a certain time. And here's what they said. Here was the final thought that left me in my mind. Thank God we don't have to be, we're at the end of our lives, we're retired, so, or on Social Security or pensions, we've saved our money, as if they've given up. And I wrote an editorial that they published about what has happened and what can we do to revive it. And it was this, everybody says, yeah, the jobs are gone. When the jobs went and the factories closed down, then suddenly everything just fell into the abyss. And that's happening now all across the United States because of COVID, but at an accelerated rate. It's like watching from the bottom of a hill, watching a gigantic landslide coming at you, an avalanche. And what do you do? And people don't know what to do now because there's no leadership to help them deal with this. All the leadership right and left are supporting corporate America, not these people. What would you suggest and what would you do if they came to you, if Biden came to you tomorrow and says, Chris, we need some help here. Can you give us a blueprint to get out of this mess? What would you share with them?
Well, Biden, along with the military and political leadership of the country, should be at best investigated and probably imprisoned for carrying out these endless wars, which have been probably the most, the most harmful strategic move in American history. The betrayal of the working class of Biden was behind this, not only in terms of NAFTA, we should have walked out on the Democratic Party after they pushed through NAFTA, but in the omnibus crime bill. Biden has bragged about expanding the death penalty crimes, federal crimes to over 50. He was one of the major architects of the Patriot Act. So, Biden is not part of the solution. Biden and everyone around him is part of the problem. And I think that we have to, the problem with people like myself on the left is that, after this assault was begun on the working class, you continued to mouth the rhetoric, but yet you were supporting a Democratic Party that betrayed every principle you claimed to stand for, including the right to privacy. We're the most watched, photographed, monitored population in human history. And when the government watches you 24 hours a day, You can't use the word liberty. That's the relationship of a master and a slave. And we didn't stand with the working class when we should. The left retreated into kind of a boutique activism of multiculturalism and identity politics. And I'm not against any of that, but those aren't political issues. They're ethical or societal issues, but they're not political issues. And the whole class consciousness, understanding of economic justice, all of that was absent. And that's what worries me, that the backlash, and we are going to, things are going to get worse, and we are going to see more virulent backlashes. But my fear is that it will become expressed through these proto-fascist movements, because the liberal class has, in essence, destroyed their own credibility. They've proved that they will fight for nothing and stand for nothing. And that was a terrible, terrible mistake. I mean, I know you, as I was, a very all supported Ralph Nader, largely because of this, that we wanted to, however futile it may be, at least and embrace a political agenda that attempted to push forward our own values. And so the anger, Richard Rorty wrote his last book about this, Achieving Our Country. The anger, and I understand the anger, is directed not only at liberal elites on the West and East Coast primarily, who many of whom have profited, these technocrats, from neoliberal policies, but it's not only angered at this bankrupt liberal class, but at the purported liberal democratic values that they claim to support. And that goes right back to Yugoslavia. The same thing happened, or it goes back to Weimar in Germany, or you can go all the way back to the end of 19th century Russia. It's what Dostoevsky wrote about, that bankrupt liberalism leads to a kind of moral nihilism. And I know you agree with me, I don't think there's any hope of reform or even being able to work with a Democratic Party establishment. We have to remove these elites. We haven't even spoken about the climate crisis. We have to remove these elites from power. Otherwise, this kind of death march, both political and finally environmental, that they've set us upon will finish us off.
I appreciate your insights, Chris. We need an hour. So when you have more time, let us know, because we need to go into the environment and the fact that no administration has honestly addressed it, not just with rhetoric, but actions, and put out the call for a national Marshall Plan where we all make sacrifices to help do our part for the environment, and to also put out the call what we can do to stop income inequality. We shouldn't have a nation that prides itself on a stock market that is at 31,000, and we have over 105 million Americans at, below, or just above the poverty line, 2 million Americans who are living on less than $2 a day, and 2 million children who have no home to go to after class each day, and 16 million children who are hungry. If we can't address those issues, it doesn't matter what you moniker a political leader as, conservative, liberal, etc. It was Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, who at least were honest enough to address these issues, start a new third party, and yet the public was mindless on this, and that's unfortunate. Thank you for your mindfulness, Chris, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.